From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the TV networks, facing declining ratings, try to drum up interest in their new shows. Then Willem Dafoe is nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal of the Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh in the film At Eternity's Gate. Dafoe studied how Van Gogh thought about his art and even learned how to paint for the role.
Van Gogh used to talk about great painting is not painting things as they are, but as you see them, which I thought is interesting.
And with a State of the Union coming up tonight, actor Bill Pullman tells us how he played the president. All that after this break.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. A couple of times every year, scores of TV reporters and critics gather for a couple of weeks and, surprise, talk television. When the journalists are not chatting amongst themselves, they're listening to presentations from the major broadcast and cable networks and the top streaming services, and almost all of the programmers are preaching versions of the same sermon. We've got some really great shows coming up. But for all of the enthusiasm from CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox, some hard truths remain. Network ratings are tumbling as viewers look to streaming services like Netflix and Hulu or cable channels such as HBO and Showtime. Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. When I got Daniel on the phone between sessions today, I started by asking him how the networks and cable channels are trying to position themselves.
There are a lot of new executives trying to stake their own position. So today we're in the process of having ABC's day, and we had Carrie Burke, who just had her first press conference. She talked a lot about ABC's brand, about attempting to program perhaps a little bit more towards women, about the importance of a lot of legacy ABC programming. So I think that's really all that anyone is trying to do these days, is make sure that whatever their corner of the pie or corner of the map or corner of the globe is, that it's defined and welcoming, I guess.
One of the things that I am most interested about Disney and ABC is they're integrating a lot of Fox executives into the programming mix now. Is there any suggestion of how the network's emphasis is going to change now that so many people who were at Fox are now part of the Disney family?
I don't think we know yet. I think we're now up to our third consecutive tour of somewhere between business as usual and clearly not business as usual, but business as not yet defined. I don't know if even come summer we're going to know exactly what the terrain is from the ABC Fox mix up.
John Landgraf, the head of FX, basically said that Netflix's numbers about its audience sizes are, well, I guess he would say that if you believe their numbers, you believe that was a really thrilling Super Bowl. What did John Landgraf say, and why is it important what he's saying about Netflix's viewership?
It really is important that we don't know what any of Netflix's numbers are. And so when Netflix announces show X or show Y is a huge hit and it was watched by this many people, the terms are completely undefined and the context is absent. And so his primary point that he made, I think, as best I could describe it, is that if Netflix only says, here are our hits, but Netflix has 500 shows and there are 495 shows that they give no data on whatsoever, it's such a skewed picture that we only know what their home runs are. We don't know what their singles, their doubles, or their strikeouts are. And that was, I think, what John Landgraf's point was, is we're not playing by the same rules, but when people report on Netflix's triumphs as if it's the same game, it makes everybody else look strange or like their numbers are low, because there's just no context for what any of the Netflix numbers mean. And I agree with that, I think.
So much of the TCAs are about the networks and cable channels and some streaming services announcing what their new programs are. But there's also been a lot of news about what shows aren't immediately coming back. FX says that it has production problems on Atlanta and it won't be back for a while. And it sounds like NBC given the not very big audience and the production problems on its live musical of Rent, are stepping back from their planned version of Hair. Is that right?
They are no longer going for Hair. They are going with looking in the direction of more family-friendly musicals. And I think that anyone who watched Rent and saw the different ways in which even that musical had to, in 2019, be censored in certain strange and not completely satisfying ways, lyrics changed, cutting away from actors doing certain things, etc. I think a lot of us watched that and went, wait a second, how on earth is NBC going to do Hair? And I think somebody at ABC, I mean, at NBC had the exact same question. And they went, oh, we really probably can't do this in a way that isn't going to upset true fans of the show. And that seems pretty reasonable to me.
The networks can obviously look at what people like HBO or Netflix and Hulu are doing and say, I understand the appeal of some of those shows. How much do you feel the networks are sticking to their own knitting, and how hard are they trying to adapt and become more relevant? Are they caught in an unusual place where they don't want to alienate their core audience by becoming something that they never have been and maybe should not become?
The drama categories at award shows have been completely dominated by cable and in recent years by streaming. And I think that a lot of the past couple of years in the development cycle has been networks saying, okay, is this a game that we have any interest in playing anymore, or do we simply not care? Is what we're doing a completely different thing? If they decide, okay, we're not going for quality, we're not going for awards, we're not trying to do what FX and HBO and Netflix do, we're trying to be popular and populist and middle of the road, then under those circumstances, you would expect, in a perfect world, there would be more large audience breakout hits. And I think they're trying to go for that. They simply haven't achieved that fully.
People who hadn't yet fallen asleep might have seen a commercial in the Super Bowl for Jordan Peele's produced version of The Twilight Zone. And that is a CBS production, but it is not going to be on the network, right? It's going to be on the CBS streaming site. Are we starting to see more content like that that may be produced by a major network, but it's not going to be on its broadcast channel?
I think we're starting to see it, but I think we're starting to see it slowly. I think that CBS, CBS All Access, obviously, there is a push that they want to make for the online home, and so that's why the Star Trek show is there and all of its associated spin-offs and associated properties. That's why The Good Fight, which, if it were actually on CBS, would be the best drama on network television. You have to give people hooks to subscribe to your service, because no one's going to do it just for one show.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He is also the president of the Television Critics Association. Daniel, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Back to your panels.
My pleasure, anytime.
Coming up, we revisit my conversation with actor Willem Dafoe. He scored an Oscar nomination for playing Vincent Van Gogh.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless. And AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement. And now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm your host, John Horn. Actor Willem Dafoe has a curious ability to go from big franchise films, such as Aquaman, to smaller indie films like The Florida Project. And last year, he starred in the movie At Eternity's Gate. Dafoe plays Vincent Van Gogh toward the end of his life. The movie, directed and co-written by the artist and filmmaker Julian Schnabel, is less interested in Van Gogh's mental health. Instead, At Eternity's Gate is focused on painting, how the Dutch artist saw light and color and texture, and about Van Gogh's friendship with a French painter, Paul Gauguin, who is played by Oscar Isaac. In this scene from At Eternity's Gate, Van Gogh is painting a portrait of the physician who treated him toward the end of his life, Dr. Paul Gachet.
Why do you paint?
I paint as a matter of fact, to stop thinking.
A sort of meditation.
When I paint, I stop thinking.
About what?
I stop thinking, and I feel that I'm a part of everything outside and inside of me.
When he says he likes to paint because he stops thinking, that's not saying thinking's bad, but a lot of his thinking is preoccupied with his failures, with his social problems, with his fear of his mental health. But when he's painting, he's connected to something. He's in movement. He finds what's eternal and what's, you know, temporal. And that is something that I relate to as a performer. When you're doing a gesture and you're not thinking what the gesture means or whether you're doing it well, you're really inhabiting the gesture, that's when you're alive. You disappear into something greater than yourself.
So much modern understanding of Van Gogh is kind of drawn along capitalistic lines. He didn't sell a painting when he was alive. He wasn't considered a success because he didn't sell anything. And there's a great moment in the film where Van Gogh was talking to a priest played by Mads Mikkelsen, and he says, God made me a painter for people who aren't born yet,
yes.
Which is a beautiful line, but it's also about the artist judging himself. Van Gogh knows he's a good painter. I mean, Gauguin tells him the same. He knows he's good.
He has his doubts.
But he knows he has something.
He feels this vision that he wants to share.
And he's prolific. He's painting so much at the end
of his life.
He's
turned on. He's connected. And that's not our invention. I mean, he painted a painting a day toward the end of his life, pretty much. And also, his letters show how connected he was.
So even if he wasn't getting money, even if he wasn't being recognized, was there a satisfaction as an artist that he was getting that maybe an actor can understand? Do you start thinking about how we judge our own work as artists today against false metrics like box office and awards?
Well, you don't, because you know that things shift. And in a similar way, we know, even in my lifetime, there are movies that were total duds when they came out that have stood the test of time and have become important and appreciated later. And the opposite is true as well. Things that were huge success fade, you know, because it's always a convergence of many things that conspire to put a value on something as subjective as an entertainment or a piece of art.
So is there a early Sunflowers in your career, the painting that nobody wanted to buy, and you look back and go, why didn't people like that? It was really good work. I mean that totally seriously. Performance that people like, maybe they didn't pay attention to, and you're like, that was one of my better paintings.
But I don't have those kind of judgments. But okay. I do. No, listen, for the experience, there's movies that I enjoy that I feel like they didn't get their day in court, or okay, they weren't appreciated. And there's other movies where I think, meh, and people love them. So
that wasn't that good.
Yeah. So it's not like I don't have opinions. I do. And it's not like I don't have favorites. But I don't lean on them, because I don't learn anything from those kind of judgments, because I'm always trying to think about what I'm doing. And yes, you're self-critical, but not self-critical in anticipating the reception. You're self-critical in what is happening, how present you are, how engaged you are, whether you're distracted, whether you're being corrupted. You know, I'm forever mindful of corruption. You know, I've seen it many times. Some actors get better. Some actors get worse. And they get worse because of certain corruptions.
We're talking with Willem Dafoe about his Van Gogh movie, At Eternity's Gate. Actors talk about how maybe putting on a pair of shoes or some piece of wardrobe or a prop helps them understand a character. In this story, did you start seeing the world differently? Did you start seeing it as a painter, which isn't reliant on a prop or a piece of costume?
Yes. It's related to an activity that you learn, you know, and I learned how to paint, and Julian was a very good and generous teacher. He taught me how to see differently, and of course, I was eager to make that leap, to see a new way, and it had a lot to do with light, and it also had a lot to do with making marks and thinking of color talking to each other. Color defined in relationship to each other. But the marks were very important because you really see when you're painting a series of marks, they start talking to each other and then they create something that you never could have supposed. Van Gogh used to talk about great painting is not painting things as they are, but as you see them, which I thought is interesting.
When you are learning how to paint.
Yeah.
Are you learning how to paint as Willem Dafoe, who is then going to paint as Vincent Van Gogh?
I'm not making those distinctions. I mean, that's a perfectly good question, but I'm not. That's going down a different road. I'm just trying to accomplish the task. And the task is, yes, first I'm getting familiar with the materials. I'm learning how to hold a brush. I'm learning where to organize my paints. But above all, how to look at things. I mean, I remember one day, Julian, we were out, and he wanted me to paint a cypress tree. And I tried to paint a cypress tree. And he was like, whoa. What? Look, you see that dark spot? You see that yellow? He started pointing these things out to me, and I started to see them. He said, well, do that. Something about you. You rush to get not the reality of it, but almost like the signifier. You know, we're so trained to have to reproduce things or have things function. If we see a tree, we want a tree. But really, what he was encouraging me to do is see everything that that tree is. It comes together in the form of a tree, but it's really shapes, colors, you know, light. And that's what you're dealing with. And when you start to think like that, you start to look at everything differently. And, of course, I'm not sustaining that all the time, but in the context of our scenarios and being Vincent Van Gogh in making this movie, you're encouraging that kind of thinking. And, of course, you're able to read his letters, which are quite sincere and quite clear and quite inspirational. And with the physical practice of painting, then you have a key into what he's talking about. And before you know it, you're talking and thinking in a way that you've never thought before. So who is that? That's Vincent Van Gogh. That's my Vincent Van Gogh.
One of the things that this film seems very intentional about as it ends is not giving the audience easy answers. This is going to be a mystery. And it does feel that the point of view of this movie is that Van Gogh was really alive and wanted to continue to be alive and wanted to continue to paint.
Yes, I think that's true. Whether that's fact, who knows? You know, certain events of his life are debatable. History does lie. It depends who's writing it, right? We know that. But toward the end of his life, he's generally considered a suicide. But there's evidence that maybe he wasn't. And there are many curious things, including the fact that he started to be recognized. He wrote a very upbeat letter to his brother the day that he was shot, or shot himself, depending on your point of view. All that's in the mix. But in a funny way, that's not what the movie's about, because the guy died. That's what's essential. And it really doesn't matter. In a funny way, at least to me, I can only speak for myself, I guess, it doesn't matter so much how he died. This movie deals more with his painting and his approach to life and work.
Willem, great to see you.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Willem Dafoe has an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor for At Eternity's Gate. It's available now on most streaming services. Coming up, Bill Pullman isn't the president, but he's played one on TV and in the movies. So how did he pull off the gravitas of a State of the Union speech?
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Are you a fan of podcasts? I suspect you might be. Well, this show is also a podcast. That's right. If you can't catch our live broadcast, you can always listen to The Frame by subscribing via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. And that way, you won't miss a single episode, like yesterday's show, which featured an interview with singer David Crosby about the new documentary that recounts his troubled life and storied career. And now, Donald Trump gives his second State of the Union address tonight. At no other time are U.S. presidents so clearly asked to essentially perform the task of president in front of an audience. Television networks and radio stations across the country will carry the State of the Union live, including KPCC, and the pundits will no doubt scrutinize Trump's performance. We don't know how Trump is preparing today, so last year we asked an actor who's played the president to tell us how he got in the mood to play the orator-in-chief. Bill Pullman has actually performed the role of president a couple of times, once in the short-lived TV comedy 1600 Penn. It was co-created by former Obama speechwriter and Pod Save America's John Lovett, and more dramatically, in the sci-fi Independence Day movies.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States!
I, of course, didn't see myself as presidential. First thing I said, it's a comedy. No, it's not a comedy. It's science fiction. But I thought, well, science fiction can be funny sometimes. So I just didn't really, the gravitas of president.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Little did I know that it didn't take a lot of gravitas. Eventually, we all learned that. But then I got nervous because then I thought, this is kind of like playing Hamlet. You know, every actor in the theater at some point have a capability of doing Hamlet. What is your Hamlet? And so you're going to do the president. What is your president? This was in the back of the days of the CDs. But the 100 Great Speeches on CD in this multi-CD collection. And it was really great for me to listen. You know, I didn't really need to see other actors playing it in movies or anything, but to listen to good speeches, you know, was a really clarifying thing. And most of them, of the important speeches, are really not that well delivered, you know. Things like Mario Cuomo's speech at the Democratic Convention of, City on a Hill.
A shining city is perhaps all the president sees from the portico of the White House and the veranda of his ranch, where everyone seems to be doing well. But there's another city. There's another part to the shining city. The part where some people can't pay their mortgages, and most young people can't afford one. Where students can't afford the education they need and middle-class parents watch the dreams they hold for their children evaporate.
That and Robert Kennedy's speech, which was impromptu, that when he had been informed that Martin Luther King had just been shot. And it was 2 minutes, I think, from when he had heard that and when he got in front of the microphone.
Could you lower those signs, please?
You could feel it in the energy. When you hear him announce to the crowd that Martin Luther King has just been killed, you hear the crowd go,
Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort.
For him to be able to articulate, you know, what he did, which was basically, I know how people felt about him, and those that felt very strongly about him feel like they've lost a brother. And he said, I can just, all I know is that I have lost a brother. You know, and then you really know you're in the present moment, and he's looking for words. He's not reading a text that he's orating, you know. That was a good one to listen to for a science fiction movie.
In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world. And you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind.
It was great to not have to, you know, insist that I'm the president, you know, have everybody just already deferential. I didn't want to be a guy who's making everybody in the room listen to him. I wanted them all to be listening to me.
But as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night, we will not vanish without a fight, we're going to live on. We're going to survive. Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
Thank you, Bill Pullman, for your insights into playing the president. And what does Stephen Colbert have to say about tonight's State of the Union? Well, here's his preview.
Now, when it comes to State of the Union, just like prom, there's an official theme. This year's theme is choosing greatness. Yes, we get a choice. The other options are selecting mediocrity, settling for racist, or fish. I will take the fish, please.
And that is our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We're back here tomorrow.
Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and best picture of the year, now playing.